May it please the Court. On direct appeal in this case, direct appeal counsel raised a claim that challenged whether the victim impact evidence in this case exceeded the bounds of what Payne had allowed because it dwelt on what Mr. Lape's family testified about as to his morally solid upbringing. And in response to that claim, this Court upheld the evidence that was presented, and I'm going to quote from this Court's opinion. This Court said, the Millers' discussion of their family's moral values was permissible in that it explained the values held by Mr. Lape. In this case, the evidence that was not presented by counsel, because they were ineffective and that was not disclosed by the state, went to expressly rebutting the image that was portrayed beginning in guilt phase of Mr. Lape and which continued extensively in the penalty phase. It commenced in guilt phase by referring to him and characterizing him, and the defense focused on attacking that portrayal as a good Samaritan. In the penalty phase,
How does whether or not he had the sexual content on his computer have anything to do with whether he acted as a good Samaritan in bringing the person who allegedly killed him into his home?
Judge, I think it goes beyond being just a good Samaritan. It also, evidence was presented about what a sterling character he had. They went through attending Catholic schools, what a good father he was.
That was in the penalty phase?
That was in the penalty phase. But it also goes, a good Samaritan, as a good Samaritan is viewed, would not have this sexual content on it.
That's going pretty far, isn't it?
I don't think so, Judge. I don't believe so at all. A good Samaritan is someone who's held out as having the highest of values. And a person who has illegal child pornography and these other chats that are on there does not reflect a person with the highest integrity and moral values.
But that still doesn't justify. The argument, I think, is your client saw all this stuff on the internet. He was outraged, and he killed him. He killed him by taking him out to a field, digging a hole, shooting him, trying to shoot him a couple of times, and then stepping on his head. I mean, this is kind of premeditated. It's not like I saw this tape and I just had to react.
Judge, I've not argued that at all in my brief.
Yes. Okay.
That was a claim that was pled, and I expressly indicated in my reply brief that there was no argument in this brief along those lines.
Okay. Because the defendant's motive was admittedly for money.
It was for money. Right. And it was for money only. And counsel knew and had a duty to investigate. They had this end case report, and they had the file names that should have put them on notice and put the co-defendant's counsel on notice to get this material. The co-defendant's counsel went and got this material and precluded the state from introducing in penalty phase all this sterling character evidence.
You know, we don't let you, as I know you know, attack the character of the victim. It can only... I think your argument is that it would come in to rebut specific... I still don't see how it's relevant to being Good Samaritan or to the other specific information that came in by the state, unless it would be to the extent they said he was a good father and those chats suggest that in fact he had sexual thoughts about his daughter. That seems to be more directly correlated, but it's not clear at all who took part in that sexual chat. But the other things are simply impugning his character because he liked to look at pornography, which is a good way to impugn character, but I'm not clear how it's a direct rebuttal to specific statements by the state.
Well, I think it is a direct rebuttal to presenting him as having attended Catholic schools, pictures from First Communion, Easter, Christmas, that they talk about adhering to these values of the Old West and that he subscribed to those and he lived those to the fullest. That's how it expresses and rebuts those kinds of things, because a person who has this kind of information, this kind of material on their computer, is not subscribing to the values that he's being held out as having. And so it does express and rebut what the state presented in its penalty phase. I mean, I think the Good Samaritan is part and parcel of the whole picture that was presented that was really expounded upon in the penalty phase. I mean, it has a dual purpose here, and the co-defendant's counsel was able to keep out, according to Swingle's own testimony, evidence that portrayed him, he cautioned them not to portray him as a saint.
If I understand, the evidence that you're talking about of the good character of the victim did not come in to show good character, because in theory, because that's not relevant, but to show how his death affected his family and so forth. Is that right?
No, the state presented portrayed him as a person of good character, which is why it makes this crime more aggravating. And if you look at, like, the majority of...
I thought victim impact evidence that sort of came in as, and that has to do with the effect on the family, and not... Because we don't really say you get the first degree if it's a really good victim, and second degree murder if it's a victim we don't like. So I thought the cases... I mean, if that was improper, why wouldn't it have objected to if it went beyond that to begin with, regardless of what was on the computer?
Judge, the problem is that this evidence really does go into character. They presented what his good character was, and they focused on it and dwelt on it, and it was the reason, it was advanced as a reason why, and counsel points out that the character of the victims and their own, and counsel testified to this, is very important to, in their past experience, to whether juries give or do not give death. And the state was focusing on this character evidence of Mr. Lake.
But aren't you kind of arguing they misused it so you get a curative admissibility kind of? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's not curative admissibility. I mean, Booth and Payne, and this court made very clear that they have a right to rebut that evidence. Mm-hmm. And Section 565.030.4 says, expressly authorizes rebuttal and surrebuttal to victim impact evidence. It uses those terms, rebuttal and surrebuttal evidence may be presented. So if the state is going to cross that line and go into the victim's character, the defendant clearly has a right under Booth and Payne and Simmons and under the statute to rebut that portrayal. And that's what the state did here. And I think the prejudice is highlighted here because the co-defendant, according to Mr. Sweeney's own testimony, kept out all of this good character evidence, and he cautioned these witnesses not to do this because the co-defendant's counsel got this. And what they did was they got the end case report, they recognized what that report showed, and had the expert who testified here get that evidence, and that restrained and kept at bay the state from misportraying Mr. Lake. I mean, that's what we're talking about here, is the jury is entitled to accurate and truthful information.
Was the co-defendant's case tried before or after this case?
It was tried after.
But your position is that the same, at least, information that was available to the co-defendant's attorney was available to this attorney. He just didn't do what it took to get that far.
Right. They should have taken the same steps, and it goes to the reasonableness or unreasonableness of Mr. Gill's counsel, in that counsel for the co-defendant got this report, recognized immediately what the content was, and because they did, they got the computer analysis done and were able to preclude the state from injecting all of this good character evidence. And had the and counsel testified here, had they had the information about the computer's contents, if the state had gone down the road that it did, they would have either presented the computer evidence, affirmatively presented it, by questioning the state's witnesses about it on cross-examination, or called the computer expert to testify about the content of the computer. So we really have prejudice here. We also have counsel not acting as reasonable counsel, and I think it's very much like Judge Breckenridge's opinion in the Jennington case, where counsel knew about the doctor in that case because it was a treating doctor. Here we have counsel who has the report. It's the officer in charge who is the forensic computer expert, and they don't even talk to him to find out what the content is. That certainly is not reasonable counsel. I mean, Mr. Kenyon testified that he elicited or stated in his examination of a witness, he always contacts and wants to speak with anyone who is in any way connected to the case. And in the Jennington case, the Western District talked about how counsel has a duty to talk to all the investigating officers.
But in the post-conviction hearing, counsel explained why he didn't, that he thought it was less important to talk about the person who handed out the assignments than to other people, and you have to make choices of how to spend your time. It wasn't that he didn't think of it. He made conscious choices that he thought were reasonable. Why doesn't that answer?
It's not a reason. When you look at those file names, to ignore those is not a reasonable decision. To see what those, how those files are labeled, and that counsel testified in retrospect, having looked at those file names now and looked at them closely, they really should have done more. He admitted that, and so did Ms. Turlington. They both testified to that. So they acknowledged that their own preparation was deficient.
But didn't he also acknowledge that he was aware the state could make an argument that some of these things on the computer, some of the chat room information was maybe generated by the defendant, and there would be an argument that the state could make the defendant was a pedophile?
Counsel never testified to that. That's entirely a formulation of findings of fact that the state prepared and the motion court signed. Counsel never said that at all. There was nothing by counsel. In fact, counsel emphatically said, if the state went down this road, and I've reproduced their testimony in my reply brief for this very reason, if they went down this road, I would have used this information to rebut the misportrayal and the inaccurate information that was given to the jury about this person's character.
Well, why didn't the record made at the PCR hearing support that finding, though? Because it shows that the chat room name and conversations didn't occur until the 2nd of July and occurred again under that name after the victim was deceased, and therefore it really could have backfired on the defense.
Judge, Officer James, the state's own expert, said Mr. Lake offered.
No, he didn't offer that as an expert. He said, I don't know, he or someone in the house. I mean, I read the conversation, I understand. But he wasn't saying, I've done an analysis of how they punched the keys or how they used their names. He said, it's on his computer. I figure he did it. That can hardly be binding.
He said he had multiple reasons, which included the profiles, that suggested to him that Mr. Lake offered it. I think that's pretty clear. He said, I'm a police officer. I believe that he was responsible. Mr. Lake lived alone, and all the sexual content he testified to said was on the computer before Mr. Gill ever came to live.
Yeah, I'm distinguishing the chat from the earlier sexual content, which he said was on earlier.
Well, as to the chat, Officer James, it was his conclusion, and I think his testimony is very clear on that. Mm-hmm. I know the state says it's not, and the state has said, oh, no. If you read it in context, and I reproduced that in my reply.
Yeah, I read it.
And I think it's very clear that he's saying, I believe he authored it. I'm a police officer. And he also said that there was no reason to think that either Mr. Gill or co-defendant Brown authored it. So that's his testimony. So the only person who could have put it on there and done the chats. We have the testimony of Mr. Cate saying that Mr. Lake did not arrive at Lake Kentucky until July 3rd, which is after the July 2nd. So we have the testimony of the co-owner of the property that he shared at Kentucky Lake saying, hey, he didn't arrive until July 3rd. So we have those two things in conjunction, which also supports what Officer James found. I believe that all of this evidence goes to disproving what the state presented to the jury was a misrepresentation and misportrayal of Mr. Lake's character. And as the co-defendant did, they prevented that from happening, and the co-defendant got life without. And that is a critical distinction in this case. The state did not go and present this evidence in the penalty phase in the co-defendant's case. The reason they didn't was because Judge Story said, if you portray him as a saint, then this evidence is coming in. And Mr. Swingle testified that I cautioned my witnesses not to portray him that way, and they did not. And their written statements did not come in, which contains all of these references to him as Mr. Mom, what a wonderful father he was, all these pictures starting with his daughter from when she was born at the hospital through her high school graduation. None of that comes in the co-defendant's case. And this all goes to what the Booth majority and also the Payne dissent pointed out is what we're doing is allowing the fate of a defendant to turn upon how good the victim is. And the state pursued that line of portraying him as an exceptional human being. He had the qualities of someone who subscribed to the views of Lincoln. Well, I don't think Lincoln would endorse child pornography or these chats. I mean, I don't think anyone would take that view. And that's the kind of language. And it was a direct quote from Lincoln that was used by one of the state's witnesses in this instance.
But Lincoln didn't know anything about chats, computers.
He did not. But the point was, Lincoln was a person who believed, who was of high moral fiber and character, and that Mr. Lape shared the views of Lincoln. Well, a person who shared those views would not be someone who has child pornography or engages in these kinds of chats. I think counsel made an important distinction between what is viewed as characterized here by Mr. Swingle as trashing the victim and what is proper rebuttal. There are certain things, and this would be proper rebuttal. It's not trashing the victim. In the cases the state relies on, all involve situations where the victim's character was not injected by the state in the first instance, or was improper, irrelevant, and it wasn't proper rebuttal evidence. In addition to the ineffectiveness claim, there is also our Brady claim, and I'm realizing I'm getting to the very end of my time in this session, and I think the court also needs to keep in mind that counsel was affirmatively represented that there was nothing relevant on this computer at all for them to be looking at. So it is either counsel was ineffective or the state withheld Brady information by affirmatively.
There's no dispute that the state's disclosures in this case would have directed defense counsel to the information if he had just connected the dots. They weren't that difficult to connect in this case, were they?
I totally agree with Your Honor that they should have connected the dots because the co-defendant's counsel did, and I think that's the perfect reason why counsel is ineffective here. The state has said that that's not the case, but I think your point is exactly the point that is
basically here. It seemed like to me your best argument was Mr. Swindle said, you know, here it is, I don't think it's relevant. I mean, isn't that basically what, wouldn't that be your best Brady argument, was that although he provided it, he said, well, I don't think there's anything on there that's relevant.
I think that is the Brady argument that we've made, is that he represented to them there was nothing relevant. I that is exactly our point, Your Honor. I see that my time is up on this session, so.
May it please the court. In State versus Powers, the Tennessee Supreme Court addressed a claim very similar to the claim that appellant brings up in this case. And in its opinion, Tennessee Supreme Court said, the purpose underlying the admission of victim impact evidence is the need to provide justice for the victim. This goal would be completely undermined if we were to grant criminal defendants unfettered discretion to disparage the victim's character. In this case, the rule that Mr. Gill seeks and asks this court to declare essentially would give criminal defendants in a capital case unfettered discretion to disparage a victim's character in the penalty phase.
But don't you open it up when you present the character present such a strong case about his being of high moral character? Don't you open up the issue?
Well, that's his argument, that this character, this adverse character evidence is admissible as rebuttal, rather than as just negative character evidence. And I know this court has read the testimony and the victim impact evidence that was presented. The victim's loved ones who testified during the penalty phase did not call Mr. Lape a saint. Now, they certainly did say things that reflected well on his character. They talked about how he reminded her of Mr. Mullen.
Didn't the prosecuting attorney refer to him as a Samaritan?
He referred to him as a good Samaritan. In his opening statement, he said to the jury, you will hear that the reason that Mr. Gill was at Mr. Lape's house was that Mr. Lape was acting as a good Samaritan and having him over at the house when Mr. Gill had no place else to go. I would submit that that is not character testimony. That is setting the stage for what the evidence was going to be. And as Judge Stith, I think, accurately pointed out, whether or not Mr. Lape had pornography on his computer has nothing to do with whether he was a good Samaritan in inviting someone in need into his home. And that same issue, that the two bits of evidence don't clash, they do not rebut, applies to every single statement made by the victim's loved ones during the penalty phase. They said things
except for the one about the daughter. But again, the daughter saying he was a good dad, and those, if he did those chats, that certainly was not a good dad.
Well, I'm not sure I would concede that. I mean, obviously, we would hope that our fathers don't have secret lives in which they have pornography on their computers.
I'm not talking about the pornography. I'm talking about the chats about his daughter.
Well, the chat in itself, I mean, we don't know, as there's an issue that you pointed out during Mr. Gill's counsel's argument, we don't know for certain that Mr. Lape put those chats on. And I would argue that there was not an adequate foundation in the record that would have allowed those chats to come forward, because clearly it would have been extraordinarily inflammatory, and without a very solid foundation, the court would certainly have been within its discretion.
But this is a death penalty case, and so for the defendant to put forward evidence for the jury to decide whether or not he's of good moral character or not, since you raised the issue, he is of good moral, he's a good Samaritan, good moral character. It doesn't necessarily say he is or isn't, but it's up to the jury to decide, and they didn't let them put that evidence forward.
Well, again, I don't think it's necessarily the case that the victim impact testimony put forth the victim as being of exemplary moral character. It said nice things about him, definitely, and that's inherent in...
A good Samaritan is someone of good moral character, I think.
A good Samaritan has good moral character, I suppose. I mean, has done something good for someone. And that was the context in which the comment was made.
But the only way they opposed that was by saying, no, it was so they could get the daughter's boyfriend.
That's right.
And that's not being pursued here.
That's correct. That's not being pursued here. And that evidence was elicited at trial. They were allowed to rebut the Good Samaritan comment in a way that actually did rebut the way in which it was the Good Samaritan comment was used at trial. And that's what rebuttal evidence should be, something that actually explains or counteracts or repels or disproves the evidence that's presented. Evidence that Mr. Lape had pornography on his computer does not disprove, it doesn't even disprove that he was a good father.
Right.
And it does not disprove that he was generous. And it does not disprove that his younger brother had pleasant memories of him. And that when they were kids, Mr. Lape carried his brother through the snow when he had a broken arm. That's the kind of testimony, obviously, that testimony reflects well on Mr. Lape's character. And a jury is going to expect that when the victim's loved ones come in, they're going to say nice things about the victim.
If those nice things don't open up all character evidence, and we've held it doesn't, what does it open up? Because you have to be able to say something in response, whether you choose to or not.
Well, I think actually the example that is in this case that we just spoke about, and the Good Samaritan could be rebutted by evidence that there was actually another motive.
The evidence that came in the penalty phase about his relationship with his children and family and so forth, how is defendant to rebut it if not with general bad character evidence?
Well, to answer the hypothetical, I think one hypothetical piece of evidence that perhaps could have been admitted, say a victim's sister came in and testified about her memories with the victim and certain things that she cared about and things that she remembered. If, for example, they had evidence that they hadn't spoken in decades and that she actually didn't know him at all and could in some way rebut mm-hmm. the specific things that she said and show that what she actually testified to could be counteracted, then that's the sort of rebuttal. Or if she had said, he never downloaded pornography.
But
perhaps that could have
been. But maybe this is a jury question. If you take Oscar Schindler, he was a person of terrible moral character, but he saved 900 lives. And so if you want to put that to a jury, you put that to a jury, the facts would be put together to put to a jury, and they're the ones that decide it. The judge here is deciding not to let this evidence in that might have a counter aspect to it.
Well, it might have a counter aspect to it, but I think it's fairly well established that with respect to this particular point, victim's character, it is not the sort of thing that juries should be considering in terms of the victim or the defendant's culpability or the...
So our cases say that...
We're already at the penalty phase, though, right?
Even in the penalty phase, the victim's character... Now, the defendant's character is certainly admissible in the penalty phase, but the victim's character is not the evidence that should be admitted. And the Supreme Court in Payne talked about how victim impact testimony was not mm-hmm. it was not but intended to be...
Are you making an argument that basically the defendant's, the scope of the rebuttal evidence is tailored or narrowed to the evidence presented by the prosecuting attorney during the penalty phase? And if so, if that's your argument, then how does that square with the fact, or is there any indication in the record as to what this particular judge would have done had the defendant offered this type of evidence?
Okay, well, to answer the first part of your question, yes, I would argue that rebuttal evidence should be restricted to rebut the evidence to which it's, this statement's coming out very badly, but it should be directed at the evidence to which it's sought to be rebutted. And so if the prosecution does not present evidence that can be directly rebutted by the evidence which the defendant seeks to put on, then that rebuttal evidence is properly excluded because it's not rebuttal evidence at all. I'm not sure that I understood the second part of your question. I think that...
Well, it's more in the nature of the opening of the door. If you want to, you know, like in this particular case, why haven't you broadened the scope of what might otherwise be admissible as it relates to the victim's character by putting on evidence of what the victim's character is? I mean, I understand you'd like to really control it as to what, but how upon review at this stage of the game can we say it's tit for tat? I mean, the door's either open or it's closed.
Well, I agree that it's open to some extent, but I would disagree that the door was, and I don't deny that by putting on the victim impact testimony, the state did to some extent open the door to proper rebuttal. But the evidence that Mr. Gill seeks to put on, this pornography evidence, was not proper rebuttal. It was beyond the scope of what the state opened the door to.
You're saying such evidence would not be independently relevant because attacking that character of the victim is not, the cases say, is not permitted unless something opens the door to it. And while this may have opened the door to some evidence, it wasn't to this.
That's correct.
What evidence, if any, then, does the record support in this case that the court excluded?
Well,
did the court exclude any evidence presented by the defendant in the penalty phase? No.
Well, certainly not the pornography evidence that we're talking about. We never got to that.
No, I understand it didn't come in. But my question is, what, if any evidence at all, did this trial judge exclude during the penalty phase?
I'm not aware of any.
Now, the co-defendant Brown's counsel did discover this pornography on the computer.
Yes, ma'am.
What's the difference between his efforts and the counsel in this case? Was Brown's attorney reasonable and operated, you know, within the standards of a competent representation? How do we judge that versus this counsel's actions or inactions?
Right. Well, in terms of evaluating the reasonableness of Brown's counsel, I don't have any reason to think that it was unreasonable for Brown's counsel to acquire this evidence and even try to use it to leverage something out of the prosecutor. I wouldn't say that defense counsel was unreasonable in doing that.
But does that make, because Brown's counsel did it, does that mean that Gill's counsel was unreasonable?
No. It does not mean that Gill's counsel was unreasonable for several reasons. First, for the reasons that I've expressed in my brief, it was not unreasonable for Gill's counsel, Mr. Kenyon and Ms. Turlington, to have no reason to think that there was anything that would be relevant to the case on Mr. Lape's computer. And they expressed this in the testimony. Both Mr. Kenyon and Ms. Turlington testified that they, first of all, they didn't think there was anything related to the motive for the murder on the computer, because Mr. Gill was very clear that the motive was money. And they also didn't think that whether or not there was any pornography on the computer would matter, probably because the victim's character is not relevant in a murder trial like this.
Well, we've held in another case where counsel didn't look at the jury questionnaires and it had relevant information, that failing to look at the document that was in your possession and seeing what information you had was incompetent. Opposing counsel says they didn't think generally look at the computer, especially in the situation they had, once they got the in-case report, they at least could have read it and seen the names of the files.
Well, and I think they did read the in-case report, actually. David Kenyon testified that he looked at the report and he refreshed his recollection with the PCR hearing and said, even at the PCR hearing, even reading this again, I don't necessarily see anything that would make me think I needed to look at this. And, I mean, I know you've read it, and the file names that are on there, some of them are certainly provocative and would make someone think that there was pornography on the computer. But as Mr. Kenyon testified, it didn't necessarily make him think it was child pornography, mm-hmm. and the file names don't necessarily show that. And even having seen that, he thought, this isn't going to be worth chasing down. I don't have any reason to think it will be relevant. And that was a reasonable mm-hmm. decision. And then, of course, in addition to it being reasonable for them not to pursue that, I would also argue that it was not prejudicial because it would not.
Well, on the non-prejudicial, your co-counsel has suggested that, look, we had a different result in the co-defendant's trial because the state was not able to use the Good Samaritan type arguments. Well, how would you respond to that?
Well, I think the first response is correlation does not prove causation. I mean, it is true that counsel in the co-defendant's case, Mr. Brown's case, did have this material, and it is also true that Mr. Brown was not sentenced to death. But it does not mean that the reason he was not sentenced to death is because they had this leverage.
I understand. Can you suggest differences other than that?
I can. And I apologize, I don't have the site, but the Southern District reviewed on direct appeal Mr. Brown's case, and some of the facts are recounted therein. Mr. Brown, first of all, put all the blame on Mr. Gill for this. He said that Mr. Gill came to him one day. He was not living with Mr. Lay, by the way. It was only Mr. Gill who was living there. Mr. Brown's story, which came in through police officers, I mean, he made statements to the police. His story was that Mr. Gill came to him and said, I need help restraining this guy because we're going to steal his money. His story was that Mr. Gill had planned the entire thing and that he was just along for the ride. Obviously, he's still guilty of first-degree murder. But the jury may have believed, based on the comparative involvement in the planning, that as a result, Mr. Brown was less culpable. And perhaps that was the reason that they decided not to impose the death penalty in that case.
Even if we disagree, if we disagree with you that counsel was not ineffective, but we agree with you that the evidence would not have been admissible, isn't there still prejudice, and didn't you just concede that there was prejudice because Mr. Brown's counsel could use it strategically to convince the state not to put the evidence on?
Well, I don't think that I conceded that there was prejudice, and I think
you said it was proper for Mr. Brown's counsel to use it in discouraging the state to put on the evidence.
But I think there's a question. But in order for that to be prejudicial, I think two things would have to be true. One, Mr. Brown's counsel's attempt to use the pornography to leverage against the prosecution would actually have to work. I mean, it would have to cause the prosecution to do something different in a material way. And I don't think that that actually is borne out by the record, and I'll explain why.
If the defense counsel in this case had objected when the prosecutor made the characterizations of the victim, should that objection have been sustained?
Possibly. It would depend on what particular portion of victim impact testimony that would be talked about. And, I mean, on this, as Mr. Gill's counsel stated in his argument, the victim impact testimony was examined on direct appeal, and this court found that there was at least not prejudicial error in admitting it. Judge Breckenridge, to get back to your question, prejudice would have to be first, the leveraging effect would have to be effective in some way against the prosecutor. That is, it would actually have to convince the prosecutor to do something different. And secondly, there would actually have to be an effect on the outcome of the trial in order for the prejudice to require reversal. I think neither are true. First of all, the record shows that and I believe this comes through Mr. Swingle's deposition testimony, that when faced with this pornography evidence in Mr. Brown's trial, they went through the motions with Judge Story, and then Mr. Swingle went to the victim's family members and said, don't go any further than you went in your testimony with Mr. Gill. I mean, I think that in itself shows that, yeah, I mean, of course, he was conscious of this. He doesn't want her reversal any more than anyone. But he also, in so instructing them, indicated that he thought that what was done in Mr. Gill's trial did not open the door to...
But in fact, they said less in that other trial. Is that right?
They said less than what they said in Mr. Gill's trial, but I think that that is also independently explainable. Judge Story refused to allow the victim's family members to read the statements that they prepared, and there's no indication in the record.
It wasn't based on the pornography, as far as the record shows.
As far as the record shows, it was not. It may have just been a personal preference of the judge. It's not clear.
One of the arguments that the state could have made in Mr. Gill's case was that some of this chat room conversation was actually conducted by the defendant, and therefore would have shown him to maybe been a pedophile. Could that argument have been made in Brown's case, since Brown didn't live with the victim? Could he have been accused of that chat room conversation?
I don't know that Brown could have been accused of the chat room conversation, but a similar argument could have been made anyway. Because the reason and the manner in which Mr. Brown's counsel wanted to use the pornography was to make Mr. Lape look bad. Mm-hmm. And so if the prosecution could have come back and said, you can't prove that the victim did any of this or had anything to do with it, then even though the chats couldn't have been attributed to Mr. Brown, it still would have undercut the foundation of allowing that testimony in. And therefore, it wouldn't have been admitted to help Mr. Brown's case.
Opposing counsel argues that it's fine for us all to say, oh, the character of the victim doesn't make any difference in the care. But in fact, it does. And so, just be realistic. And this would have maybe affected the jury, even if ostensibly everybody's treated alike. Nobody should get murdered. If you're a drug dealer, the jury's going to react differently. Or child pornographer.
It may have. And that's exactly why it's so important that the court is vigilant about the prejudicial effect of potential victim character evidence. Absolutely, evidence of child pornography is extraordinarily inflammatory. And if this had been brought out, even in the penalty phase, suddenly this trial wouldn't have been about murder. It would have been about child pornography. And that's what the jury would have been focused on. I mean, that's what we've been talking about for the last 30 minutes. Murder has hardly ever been mentioned.
And but I knew when you put your testimony on that they could put the child pornography on as rebuttal. I mean, once you open the door, if you didn't open that door, they wouldn't be able to bring it in.
Well, I don't think
you knew that was laying out there.
Well, look, isn't almost the converse true? Doesn't this record more suggest that Mr. Swindle knew, although I don't cast any fault on him because of his disclosure, he knew they didn't have the information. So it's possible that he exploited the fact in this case that they didn't have the information but was afraid to try to exploit the fact in the second trial.
Well, I don't know that that's the case. I mean, I think
we know he didn't try to offer it in the second trial.
He didn't try to offer as much victim impact testimony? I'm sorry.
He was more cautious about opening the door as it relates to character.
I think that's correct. He was more cautious.
Changed his opening statement.
And the judge had specifically cautioned him prior to the second trial. But I don't think that it followed. I mean, I think that if the judge in the second trial, in Mr. Brown's case, had allowed the defense to bring in all this evidence of child pornography, that would have been an abuse of discretion. I mean, I don't think it should be assumed that
But that's really not what we're looking at here in this case. I mean, we're looking at, possibly the issue of whether or not, there was prejudice. In other words, would it have affected the outcome, death versus life without? And juries sometimes are hard to predict, and you've given some explanations as to why you think they would have been different. But maybe prosecutors are a little more predictable. And maybe he had all the facts at hand. And maybe Mr. Swindle knew that defense counsel didn't have this type of evidence. So he wasn't so guarded in the sense of opening the door to potential evidence regarding the victim's character.
Yeah, if I may respond.
Sure.
I mean, it's certainly true that he was more cautious in Mr. Brown's trial, but I do not think that's attributable to him exploiting a difference in information. But instead, I think he correctly and reasonably believed that this pornography evidence was absolutely immaterial to this case. And when, in the second trial, Judge Story said, you know what, I think maybe this might open the door, and Mr. Swindle opposed that, and he filed a motion with cases explaining why he didn't think that was correct. But at the same time, it was totally reasonable for the prosecutor to be a little more cautious because he wanted not to even risk any additional error. But I don't think it follows that that means that in the first case, he was exploiting an indifference in information or that there was prejudice in this information not coming forward. Thank you very much.
I'd like to address a couple of things the state has said here. The state is focused on that in Brown's trial, the focus was blaming Gill. Well, in Gill's trial, Gill blamed Brown. Gill's statements were that Brown was a bad actor here. So it goes to showing prejudice here. The state wants to distinguish it that Brown blamed Gill. Well,
but there was a major difference in that Gill was the one who was living with the victim and knew about the money and I mean,
Gill lived with him. But
there were many other circumstances that were different beyond this evidence.
I don't think there were many circumstances. I think Gill and Brown were there, and they were close associates, so they were frequent. He was frequenting with Gill the home there, but also Gill's statement was that Brown was the shooter. That's what the evidence was in this case. And that's one of the issues this court decided on direct appeal was. An issue that went to that particular issue as to the disjunctive being submitted because Gill was blaming Brown.
You seem to be, if I understand your argument, it's basically that the state opened up victim character evidence, and so you could put in all this and make the victim's character a major issue in the penalty phase. And if the state went too far and went into the victim's character, that might have been separately objectionable. But our cases are clear. The victim's character in itself is not supposed to come in. You can rebut the victim impact, but not the victim's character per se. That we don't want a mini trial on if it was a good or bad person. And so I'm not, most of this evidence, surely all of this wouldn't have come in, even if the court had permitted you to put in some kind of rebuttal. It would have been to specific victim impact evidence, not to try the general character of the victim, and certainly not to go into all the pornography, because that would be a side trial, in effect.
Judge, I think when the state in presents evidence, he's a Mr. Mom, it goes into his generosity, these Old West values, that he has Lincoln-esque character.
But you're, in effect, saying the state shouldn't have been able to put that on to begin with. That was general character evidence, not victim impact. That has nothing to do with the pornography.
That was general character evidence, and that's what they did. And if the state is going to open it up, certainly Mr. Gill is entitled to rebut what they opened up.
Wasn't it just the answer would have been to object to that as being not permitted?
Well, that's not an ineffectiveness claim that was raised here. The ineffectiveness claim here is that counsel should have had this evidence to have prevented all of this from going on, and that's what Brown's counsel effectively did. And Mr. Swingle testified that he did not inject all of this evidence in Brown's trial. And the state, in fact, says in its own brief, these written statements, which talk about the statements like Mr. Mom and his Lincoln-like character, were kept out of Brown's trial, and the very reason they were kept out is because Brown's counsel had this stuff. I want to address Judge Fisher's question about rulings, and in particular, Judge Fisher. The judge who served as the PCR judge was not the trial judge. He disqualified himself, so we don't know how a particular trial judge would have ruled on this particular evidence. We do know that Judge Story said that if you inject the victim's good character, then you've opened it up. And if you present that he's a saint, which is what he did, effectively, Mr. Swingle, that you've opened it up, and that's the consequence.
And since it's a penalty phase, you only really need one juror to say not death to win the penalty phase on your side.
That would have prevented a death verdict. Certainly right. It would have. Absolutely, Your Honor. That's exactly right. The state refers to this Powers case from outside of Missouri, and that Powers case also indicated in that case the trial judge had ruled that if it's opened up the victim's character, then those kinds of things can't come in as rebuttal. So none of the cases the state has provided stand for the proposition that we're precluded from presenting proper rebuttal, because Booth, Payne, Simmons make very clear, in this state's own statute says rebuttal evidence is proper, and this was proper rebuttal evidence. If there are any other questions, my time has expired. I ask that the court reverse otherwise.
Thank you. The cases are taken under submission.